This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Wild and dangerous weather, melting ice caps and glaciers, new heat records and acid seas, nothing persuades the small army of climate science deniers. They are contrarians, aging academics, right-wing politicians, lonely trolls, and front group institutes with a post office box and a carefully hidden stream of money coming from big oil and coal. Dr. John Massey, a California computer scientist, has tracked them down. You're about to hear his talk, The Machinery of Climate Anti-Science. I recorded it in Vancouver, Canada on April 7th, 2011. You can find a PDF document with his notes and all the graphs at the website for the Pacific Institute for Climate Solutions, or link directly from my show blog at ecoshock.info. Dr. Massey was a longtime computer guru working at Bell Labs and then as chief scientist for the supercomputer company Silicon Graphics. There he met the climate scientists who needed the fastest machines in the world. Massey was outraged to find those same scientists faced death threats, harassment at work, and odd legal wrangling. The U.S. Congress was misled by plagiarism in a university academic report. One climate scientist is suing for libel and winning. Massey set out to find out who was behind these attacks and who paid for them. Put on your smog glasses. We're going on an expedition through fake institutes, the same PR companies who protected big tobacco, using some of the same bought-out expertise, right up through the clouds of lobby institutes claiming to be nonprofits, to the billionaire fossil fuel men in the sky. Here is Dr. John Massey.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks for all you coming out here. The idea here on the front is that there's a machine over here which does its best to hide how it works, but its job is to generate confusion over the science. The idea is to obscure the science. It's oddly inherited from the tobacco wars in a very direct way for odd reasons. And in particular, what they obscure the most is the funding. The funding here, I'm only a little ways into it. It is one of the most convoluted money laundering schemes I've ever heard of. It's very cleverly done. It's very hard to find. I spent a lot of time tracking money around. You can find maybe 20 to 50% of the money flows, and what you find is already indicative, but there's a lot more sloshing around, and that is very craftily hidden. So the PDF of this thing will be posted at the PICS website, and I thank them very much for organizing this trip. At SGI, the marketing folks used to complain at me that I had more diagrams and stuff on my slides. I said, yes, and those are the most requested slide sets in Silicon Graphics, and they stopped bothering me then. I'm going to give a little more background. This is how a poor computer scientist slash executive, because really I'm also a business executive, sort of stumbles into this weird alternate universe where physics doesn't work. Right? I used to be studying to be a physicist, and gee, stuff that I learned as a sophomore somehow in this alternate universe of anti-science doesn't work, okay, at all, right? That's curious, right? So I started helping out and sort of started studying the machinery, and I'll explain that. You have to understand, this is more like military intelligence or studying mobs, investigative reporting, where people are hiding things on purpose. And so you have to work hard to figure out what's happening. It's not like science, you know. There's lots of complicated science questions, but the universe doesn't try to hide from you. Right, or fool you, you know? Universe doesn't lie. Some people lie. So, from December 2009 to current, I want to give an example of the working of the machinery's gears. And it's particularly appropriate that these talks be given first in British Columbia, because not only have the folks at DeSmog Blog, which is Vancouver-based, helped me out a lot with publishing stuff, but a person who goes under the name Deep Climate has been British Columbia based. He found a little problem with this 2006 Wegman report. And how many people have heard of the Wegman report? Some of you. Okay, I'll explain more what that is. It's something that's not cited in science because it isn't, but it's cited by every climate anti-science book as the proof that global warming isn't happening. What happened is he found a couple small problems. If people remember the original Watergate that started with a burglary that had nothing to do with Richard Nixon, this is like that, okay? This is a few pages of plagiarism, and then it got more and more and more and more, and other helpers, it's been interesting. So there's all kinds of things already out of this. There are academic misconduct complaints. There were articles in USA Today. There will be more. There will probably be funds misuse cases, okay, that will come up in misuse of federal funds. There may even, if I can get them to happen, be felony charges, because it is a felony to mislead the U.S. Congress. All of this is in service of looking for actionable problems, not just that somebody says something crazy. At the tail end, I'll talk about defogging or desmogging the machine and throwing rocks in the gears. My motivation for this is I have a bunch of climate scientist friends who've become friends. I went to a luncheon one time where 4 out of the 5 people at lunch get death threats regularly because of research they do for people's grandchildren. It gets me mad, right? Also, when I was designing and helping sell supercomputers, I often talked to climate modelers. And that was really interesting because they always wanted bigger computers to make better models. And we talked about what science they needed to know and, where bigger computers could help them and where they couldn't. Anyway, it was very, very useful. But then I got sucked into this weird climate stuff. And so this is the more relevant piece for this. I started following blogs and things and websites, and I got curious, why were so many people certain that the scientific consensus was all wrong? And I went down all the arguments against global warming, and, I'm a skeptical guy by nature. Here would be an argument. It might look good on a website. I'd go research it, and I'd cross them off. And through 2005, they all got crossed off except for one thing, and that was the fact that the satellites disagreed with the ground stations. Well, in 2005, they found bugs in the programs that were making it look like it was getting cooler with the satellites. Turned out there was, there was something where they added something rather than subtracting, and it reversed things. And all of a sudden, things agreed. Well, this is how a real skeptical person does stuff, is you look at the issues and you study them and you see whether they stand up. They didn't stand up. So I wonder, why is this? Is this bad communication by scientists? Are they not doing a good job? Or maybe journalists aren't doing it right. Or is it something else? Well, 2007, this lady up here, Naomi Oreskes, came and talked at Stanford. And I'm within bicycle distance of Stanford, so I go there a lot. And she impressed me. She described how she wrote a paper for Science in 2004, short one, about consensus about climate, and then started getting hate mail and nasty phone calls in the middle of the night and stuff like that. Right? Now, Naomi's become a very good friend of ours, and she is not a person you want to do that with. Okay, she's smart, highly respected, and she's a geoscientist turned science historian. Now, you can attack climate scientists because they want to study climate science and get science done. Historians may turn around and study you. Bad target. All right, this fellow is the Viscount Christopher Monckton. How many people have ever heard of him? Oh, lots of you. Oh, goody, okay. How many people have ever seen Monty Python Upper Class Twit Race? Yes, okay. There are some similarities, okay? Okay, so he and a fellow named Schulte mounted an attack on Naomi. They wrote nasty letters to her and her chancellor demanding resignation and or apologies. And just by coincidence, they put it out on Business Wire the same day. Oh, that's how you settle academic disputes. You put it out on Business Wire. Well, that makes sense, right? And this SPPI is the Science and Public Policy Institute. Science and Public Policy Institute, that sounds like a good thing. Well, it doesn't do science. It's not an institute. It is certainly not for the public. It would like to affect policy. It's actually one guy whose address is a post office box and a UPS store. But it sounds pretty good, right? It's sort of Monckton's home away from home. Well, the kind folks at DSmog Blog published the study I did on this. Then Moncton somehow got an article into a newsletter for the American Physical Society. That was a sort of funny mess. I sort of helped fix that up. Then a bit later, there was a petition to that same society by, how many people recognize the name Fred Singer? Yes, okay, he's not a nice guy. Will Happer is also not one. I'm on their bad list, too. And I wrote up how this petition worked, and they were not very happy. Then ClimateGate happened, and I was helping Mike Mann, people know that name, with Penn State. I'm an old Penn Stater, and I still know a lot of people. So Penn State's a very good school. I knew they would handle it okay, but they are not used to these weird extra science attacks that are PR efforts, right? So I was trying to educate them about how this stuff worked. Deep climate set us all off on a very strange journey that I never expected. He found a couple pages of plagiarism in the Wegman report, and then more came out and more came out. The reason for doing it was to document all this stuff, because this is more like a criminal investigation. Sometimes connections that aren't obvious get, you know, happen later. You realize that some data you had actually means something. Okay, so let's just start with the attacks. Here was this attack on Naomi. This was this new think tank with big involvement from Moncton. He may well be funding it. I can't tell that yet. A lot of debunking went on at the Deltoid blog, which is Australia. Now, this whole thing is international. A lot of the attacks started in Canada, actually. But it's a very international thing on both sides. So, attack UK-US, a debunk coming organized in Australia, but with help from other people. This gave me ideas about social networks of climate anti-science. Here's what happened. When I looked at this SPPI thing, it had a bunch of advisors from all around the world. Here's one from the UK, a couple from Australia, rest from the US. And when I looked up these people, they were also advisors or something at a whole bunch of other places. And I said, wait a minute. All of these things have a list of who are advisors. There really aren't that many people. They're just all over the place, you know? And you would find people who were advisors at 8 or 10 different places. So I started keeping lists. And every time I saw a new petition or somebody talking at an anti-science conference, I stuck them on the list. I kept track of activities. I built up a giant spreadsheet because you couldn't tell what was happening. I'm a scientist. I gather data. Okay, this was this silly thing with the... it's an example where some naive editors ended up asking Moncton for a physics article. Those of you who know about Moncton know this is pretty silly, but it happened through a bunch of silly accidents. Well, it got wiped out pretty quick. There was, once again, DSmug blog had some good stuff. Australia had some good stuff. Canada had some good stuff. It did show that even a few physicists can ignore physics. Science societies are pretty good at the top once they know there's a problem, and they acted very quickly. It sort of helped that a guy I knew who's a Nobel physicist, and I told him about this, and half an hour later, he fired off a blowtorch to folks. And having a Nobel physicist tell you that you've really screwed up, you know, gets attention. There can be vulnerabilities here. Like this guy here, Larry Gould, he's a newsletter editor for the New England section, and he's become a big Moncton fan. He invited Moncton to talk at his school, you know. He promotes him on his webpage. If you go look at this thing finally, you should look at this webpage. It's in a different universe, whatever it is, okay? Now, however, this stuff is confusing. I thought he was the guy who really fired this up. Turned out it was somebody else who gave Moncton's name to these editors. In fact, he gave 6 people's names, of whom they knew 5. They all said no to write the opposing global warming side of a pair of articles. They wrote a letter or email to Moncton addressing him as Dr. Moncton. He has a classics degree. Moncton somehow never managed to correct their misimpression. Supplied him this article, and it was bad. Well, we got rid of that, but I warned the poor editors. I said, you are now about to be subject to having a toothless chihuahua barking away, gumming your ankle for a long time. And they did. Moncton claimed it was peer-reviewed. No, it wasn't. Okay. Moncton wrote letters saying how evil and bad the APS was. It did all kinds of stuff. All this propagated through the blogosphere. It was just truly amazing. Moncton appeared on DSmog blog and said, I was under investigation. He quoted Dr. Massey all over the place, which is sort of funny, and he said, Dr. Massey should publish peer-reviewed stuff rather than unlawfully interfering with the blogosphere. Now, this is a crime I haven't known about, okay? How do you interfere unlawfully with the blogosphere? This is like interfering with chaos. I mean, so there was a period when I was number one on Moncton's bad list. Fortunately, other people have gotten above me by now. Then there was this petition. Now, this was funny. This was some fairly well-known physicists like Fred Singer and Will Happer. They wanted to change the climate position from a normal, yes, it's a serious problem, to no, nothing's happening, and it's all natural variation, and even if it is warming, it doesn't really matter, it's okay. You know, it was one of these vague kind of things. This was an unusual petition because most of the people actually could be found. You could tell who they really were. And not only that, because they're publishing scientists, or were, you could find out who they worked with. And they came in waves. Well, what this let me do, this was sort of the waves of growth of this thing. In about 6 or 7 months, they got 206 people to sign this out of the 45,000 that are APS members. So that's less than 0.5%. Anyway, the result was, is I was able to go in and look at the social networks of how this was really spread.
You are listening to a presentation by Dr. John Massey. It's called The Machinery of Climate Anti-Science, right here on Radio EcoShock.
Are people familiar with the term astroturf? AstroTurf is artificial turf, but it also means you're trying to fake something that looks like a grassroots effort from the bottom up, but it's really heavily organized or driven by some small group. So that's an AstroTurf group. So this was supposed to be a petition of the membership. Well, it was a petition of Fred Singer and his friends and his friends, and you could see the layers come. So that was interesting. The demographics were quite instructive. The age distribution, this is the approximate age distribution if this group were taken from APS membership itself. This was the age distribution of the signers. That is, almost half of the people were emeritus or retired. Now, I know a lot of emeritus scientists who are sharp, sane, still contributing, still helping students, but some go emeritus in the bad way, over the edge. And these are physicists who basically, in effect, say conservation of energy doesn't work. I mean, that's what it comes to. Like, well, okay, I thought that was the law. The next thing was they were heavily skewed in political donations, 16-1 on the conservative side. Now, let me be really clear on this. I don't think that views on global warming have much to do with one's position on the correct size of government or what goes on, okay? I'm a centrist independent. I've never been a member of either party. And, of course, I live in California, and you probably have heard of our governor, our ex-governator, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's a Republican who has fought very hard to deal with climate change. Gender, this one isn't significant, but it's very heavily male. It turns out lots of the anti-science stuff is done by males, very few by females. The reason it's not significant is there just aren't enough older female physicists in this sample to know. There's only a few of them, so you can't really tell. Geographic clustering, it was real obvious that these things were clusters around the key people that organized this thing, right? There were a whole bunch at Los Alamos Labs, you know, where they did nuclear bomb stuff. There was a whole bunch of Southern California aerospace folks. There's a bunch in Virginia. There's a whole bunch around that guy Larry Gould in Connecticut. And the geographic clustering was clear. Bottom line here was ideology can nullify laws of physics. You may not have known that, you know? Strong belief, laws of physics out the door. Okay, so now let me go to some definitions and talk about cigarettes, which turned out to be incredibly important to this. So science, people kind of know what science is. You actually gather evidence and make hypotheses and prove them or disprove them. You could argue fiercely, but it's on evidence. Yes, personalities matter. Sometimes that gets washed out. I wrote this thing called How to Learn About Science. The Great Wall analogy was the idea that science isn't built from plans, it's accumulated brick by brick. You're not sure where it's going to go, but once you've built the Great Wall, just because a brick gets a little loose doesn't mean the whole wall falls down. Some people seem to think that if they can find one paper that disagrees with global warming, it'll all disappear. And every month we see yet another paper that turns out to be wrong that makes it disappear. Pseudoscience. This is where you try to convince scientists of weird ideas even though the evidence is piled up otherwise. So ESP, astrology, is a guy who really believes the sun is made of iron. And any blog, this guy will show up and talk about the sun being iron. And by the way, global warming is wrong, okay? And if you really want to see great examples, there's what I call the dog astrology journal, called the Journal of Scientific Exploration. This has actually been quoted as a crucial source by the Canadians, McIntyre and McKittrick, and the guy who wrote the book called The Hockey Stick Illusion. They actually quote this journal. We say called a dog astrology journal. One of the papers it published was a study of 500 Parisian dogs to compare versus their astrological signs to see if it affected their personalities. And yes, it affected them as much as it affects human personalities. And this was a very serious, technical-looking article. And you may not have known that Parisian puppies have signs, but they do. Ugh, weird, okay? Science noise, you know, science communication isn't easy. Often there's noise. When you go from real science through the media and to the public, there's noise in the signal. And that's just, you know, that's life. I've worked a lot with the press. It's hard to get stuff right, particularly in a small article. Anti-science is something different. This is where you're trying to obscure science to make sure because you don't like the policies that might come from it, and you want to get rid of the possible policies. So this is different. But pseudoscience, you know, has all kinds of ideas, and they're not very organized. Anti-science turns out to be very well organized and very well funded. Here's the idea. Science is done. It accumulates. When the government wants an opinion on things, you put together a review panel of senior scientists. They do an assessment report that looks at a lot of things. In the U.S., that's the National Academy of Sciences. You give this information to the governments and the public. Some argument goes on. You make some decisions. And you get policy, you know, informed by the best science you can have at the time. It may change later, but it's like you do the best estimate. This is what Steve Snyder was great about talking about where there's uncertainty and where there isn't, okay, or how much there is and the fact that, yes, you don't know everything, but you sometimes know enough that you should be able to make good decisions. Well, some people don't want the actions that might happen here. The goal is to sort of wipe that out, make sure it doesn't happen. The tactic is to throw up a whole lot of fog on top of this and always be saying, well, we need more research. Well, we need more research. Some people have been saying we need more research for 20 years. And you know what? You always do need more research, but that doesn't mean you haven't learned anything yet. Okay, and you just throw the old research in the trash. And there's all kinds of tactics for doing this. Where they came from was the tobacco industry. And I'm sorry, I feel bad as an American, we foisted this on the world. Have people ever heard of the tobacco archives? This came out of the settlement with the tobacco industry in the late 90s, and it basically got all of their internal documents. And believe me, reading this is a real eye-opener. Well, this was a strategy put together by the PR firm Hill & Knowlton for tobacco companies back quite a while ago. They could see the scientific evidence was piling up in a way they didn't like. So here were the tactics. Well, it's still inconclusive. Hey, it may be something other than smoking. You know, you can't trust statistics. It's a scare. It's too complicated, blah, blah, blah. Well, replace smoking by CO2, and it's all the same tactics. Yeah, what's funny is it's often the same think tanks and fronts and people. Because you can go back in to the tobacco archives. You can find a whole bunch of the conservative think tanks who ended up helping the tobacco companies all the time. And what's funny is most of these entities are tax-free nonprofits, even though they are really PR lobbying agencies. And I hope at some point maybe something will happen to that. I hope. Now look, some think tanks can be legitimate advocates for smaller government, less taxes, less bureaucracy, whatever. While I often disagree with the Hoover Institution, they're one of the few that weren't in the tobacco gang. And they have people there whose opinions I respect who take rational scientific positions on things. Some of these other things are really PR agencies for hire that then wrap a mantle of business and small government around them. I've been a business guy. They don't represent me. You know, they just, well, I mean, particularly, is it a conservative value to addict children to nicotine? Because the only way somebody really gets addicted is to start between 12 and 18. The habit has to be established for most people while your brain is still developing. And the tobacco companies have known this forever, for a long time. There's this great one here called The Importance of Younger Adults. You may not realize that 12 to 18 are younger adults. They know if they don't get them early, they won't. All right. I mean, that's laid out in this document, right? And these think tanks, the same ones that do climate anti-science, were right in there pitching for decades. But it does pay well. So how does the machinery work? Well, let's look at this. This is the tip of the iceberg. It's complicated. If you go read the documents, it's got all the details. The idea is money flows in the top from corporations and especially certain family foundations. And I'll mention a few of the key ones. It goes into this vague cloud of money. It's wonderful money laundering. It's very hard to figure out where the money is going, and because sometimes it goes through two or three separate steps through PR agencies and front organizations and think tanks and just all kinds of stuff, right? That's why all these things go in different directions. The red things are where ideas come from. Memes, that is, wrong ideas about climate, like global warming stopped in 1998. That'll come out and it'll propagate all the way across the internet and everything. Just doesn't have to be true. Anyway, these people over here are the spokespeople, tend to generate this stuff. The ideas flow back through the PR agencies and think tanks. They do the publicity. These guys are very good PR folks. If you can help get people's kids addicted to nicotine, confusing people about climate is child's play, because it's a lot more complicated. So these are some of the best marketeers on the planet, right? And they're good at it. Now, spokespeople, some of them, like Fred Singer, have been doing this for 20 years. Others come and go. They tend to use them up, because after a while, people realize that, you know, they keep saying nonsense, and they fade out. And so there's a long history of people popping up, being used as a spokesperson, and then they need new faces. The new faces actually shows up in certain documents we've seen, where they say, we need to get new faces, new voices to add to the ones we already have. The media and the internet is another big cloud here, and the public then is sort of split by one of these reports of good analysis, sort of people who know that there is no such thing as climate change and are willing to write letters and post things in the blogs and everything. There are people who are uncommitted, and there are people who understand the science or trust science enough that they don't believe it. The clear goal is to move people from uncommitted into completely disbelieving the science. The other goal, of course, as politicians get involved, is maybe you get more votes. It's sad to see the Republican Party and the Tea Party, where apparently in order to even be allowed to exist, you have to sign up saying there's no such thing as global warming. And a whole bunch of politicians who used to be moderates now say, no global warming, I'm sure of it, you know, politician. So let me expand this. Again, here's the big cloud. Sometimes you can find the money, like ExxonMobil Educational Foundation has to report where the money goes. I have no idea why they did it that way, because the amount of money is rounding error in a day's profits. But they did it that way, and you can track it. The family foundations donate to various people, and those things are reported. Down here, you can find out how much money they got, but you don't know where they got it from. You can usually find 20 to 50% of it from these guys up here. The rest of it probably comes directly from corporations or through who knows how much.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We have more from Dr. John Mashey coming right up. He's the California computer scientist who made a map of anti-science supporters of big oil and coal. It's all on his spreadsheet and lecture notes, available as a free PDF download at the Pacific Institute for Climate Solutions.
The real prize is to get a scientist actually in the field to say, no, it's nonsense. And so they really court them and help them and do whatever they can whenever you find them. There aren't very many of these. On the other hand, you can get some other kind of scientist and they can speak and do stuff. Here's a funny thing. Having a PhD is used for truthiness. Do you know the term truthiness? It sounds truthy. It may not be truthy. Why a nuclear physicist should be listened to about climate is unclear. Like, and you shouldn't listen to me about climate. You should listen to a real climate scientist. I'm actually an expert on climate anti-science, and I actually know a lot of climate scientists, but I'm the wrong guy to listen to it. You know, I'm a computer scientist and other stuff. But anybody with a PhD can be usefully added to lists and used as a spokesperson. Hacks here will do anything for anybody. They like to get... Well, there are some like that. Steve Malloy is probably in that category. I mean, he'll go do any anti-science thing for any industry whatsoever. It's nice to get folks who write op-eds, right? If you can get some of them, that's a good catch, too. And the public down here gets confused by all this. I don't blame the average person for being confused. This is complicated, and there's a very good machine generating confusion. And you know what? It's always easier to create confusion and doubt than it is to have clarity about stuff. You know, there's a thing called... Anybody hear of the Gish Gallop? Yeah, a few know. Okay. The Gish Gallop is where you throw out 20 different things in a few minutes. You know, like, it's warming on Mars. Okay, it's warming on Jupiter. Must mean the sun is getting brighter. Well, it isn't. Warming has stopped in 1998. It's all in the oceans. It's just natural oscillations. Well, you can churn out this stuff in a few minutes. You can't debunk this stuff in that short a time. They do that. Well, it sounds confusing. All you need is for one of those ideas to stick in somebody's head, and they say, oh, Mars is warming. Well, you know, maybe there is a problem there. It's a tactic. Okay, that was a review of what that whole thing looked like. I've been sort of studying this machinery for a couple years now, and it's a great money and meme laundering scheme. Now, I want to say just a few words here about why people get into this. And people say you're paid by an oil company or a coal company. You're paid by an oil company. Well, most people saying this stuff aren't. At least not directly. Some of them are getting paid through four levels deep of stuff, and I found some money that flows like that. But realistically, there are financial incentives. There are ideological or political incentives, right, for some people. There are psychological things. Like, some people are just natural contrarians. Sometimes, though, you can get more attention with a contrarian position than you can with, yes, I accept the normal science. Then there's ego, where you think you're smarter than everybody else. I'm afraid this is an example. See this book here? Global Warming for Dimwits. Possibly the worst climate book I've ever seen. This is a just retired chemistry professor who's never published very much or anything about climate. Having retired, he decided that anyone who believes in global warming or that CO2 has anything to do with it is a dimwit. So the National Academy of Science and all the climate scientists and a whole lot of Nobel physicists are all dimwits. But he knows better. He knows better. It's like the guy has 8 references in the whole thing, and most of them are bad. And he's just, you know, it's just unbelievable. Well, I doubt he's getting paid by any oil company. I think this particular one is going emeritus. You go off the edge after you've retired, right? Most scientists don't, but a few do. Dunning-Kruger effect, anybody ever hear of this? Okay, Dunning-Kruger is where those of lower skill and knowledge way overestimate what they know. This shows up all the time. People are absolutely sure they know more than anyone who's ever studied this stuff. But it's a strong effect. This is why I call this a crescendo to ClimateGate. I mean, it's just one thing after another of new conferences with anti-science stuff, with vague funding and letters to the presidents and big petitions. And, you know, the noise level is just absolutely huge, right? The interesting thing is, an awful lot of this, if you see who's involved, it's the same bunch of folks. It's the same organization. So here's what I found. These are funders who give money to certain organizations here that are involved in climate anti-science. T at the top means there's a tobacco connection, meaning either we know the tobacco connection from something else or you can find them in the tobacco archives. Because the tobacco companies would write memos like, here's who really helped us out and here's how much we paid them. It's in the memos and it's in the archives. I have a whole long list of bookmarks of this stuff and there's references to all this, okay? It's just, yeah, that's what they did, right? This is what there's funding here. The N is for nonprofit. Notice these are all nonprofits. This is where our U.S. tax dollars, these are mostly U.S. Oh, but you got one here. Notice the Canadian symbol. I don't know, you guys up here seem to go for more centralized stuff. You have kind of one really big think tank and a couple little ones. We have a whole horde of them. I mean, they're all over the place. Here are who funded. There's two different estimates for Exxon funding. These are the top couple family foundations. This is a slice. This is a one-third slice of this page, the top couple ones, right? Now, let me tell you who these are. Allegheny Carthage, Sarah Scaife, and Scaife family is a fellow named Richard Mellon Scaife. Okay, he's the heir to the Gulf Oil fortune, which turned into Texaco or Chevron. Actually, his foundations, though, have very little Chevron stock. I don't think he likes Chevron much, but he has some ExxonMobil stock, and he has a whole lot of tobacco stock for some reason. And he's pretty intensely conservative. Anybody hear of Swift Boats? Swift Boats and the John Kerry thing? Yeah, that's him. Behind that. I'm a Pittsburgh boy, as this guy is, and he funds a lot of stuff. He has a special think tank in Pennsylvania, and its job seems to be to bother Michael Mann at Penn State. It takes out ads in the student newspaper attacking Mike. I mean, how'd you like to be a professor and find full-page ads in the student newspaper saying how evil you are? Now, the next group down here, this next three, are the two Koch brothers in the Lamb Foundation. It's also them. How many people have ever heard of the Koch brothers? Oh, lots of you. Good, yeah. They don't really like to be heard of, okay? For those of you who haven't, the Koch brothers run the second largest private company in the U.S. They typically violate environmental laws all over the place, and they're in fossil fuels of one kind or another, as well as various other things. There's a couple things they don't like. No environmental regulation whatsoever is ever anything they would like. Certainly, the idea of any CO2 regulation is just like beyond the pale. And they would also just as soon see the federal government go away. And they're willing to pay for it. And they're two of the top 10 richest guys in the U.S. So they can pay. So here's another whole bunch of them. And, you know, I selected the first 50 of these things. I've got spreadsheets that go to 100 of these entities. They all, see, it's much better to have a whole bunch of little things because it sounds like more people were involved. But it's the same funders. I mean, what you can see is, gee, they're right there with Exxon. And, you know, that's it might be Scaife, it might be Koch, it might be somebody else, but they're all in the same stuff. One important one here is this one here called George Mason University. Notice George Mason University actually gets quite a bit of money. We'll come back to them later. This is where Ed Wegman works. Oh, Koch Industries. Okay, and then there's a bunch of subsidiaries and things. They're Kansas-based, a lot of natural gas. They're actually, I think, getting into the tar sands stuff. It's like a $50 billion company that most people have never heard of. And these guys really do not like the spotlight on them. Anyway, they've gotten a lot more attention lately. Oh, they are, by the way, the funders of the two front organizations that were the spark plug for the Tea Party. So here's more organizations. There's even one in Australia. Those organizations, you know, just for fun, I took the words that were in the titles of these things. The most popular word was institute. Now, an institute, what do you think of as an institute? It's a bunch of people who do research, right? Well, it could be one person in a website, in a post office box, you know, in a suburban UPS store. There's several like that. They say science, but none of them have ever done any science that I've ever been able to find. They call foundations, but usually they're PR lobbying agencies. They don't have much to do with the public. They certainly don't do real research, but they do like to affect policy. So this is sort of Orwellian doublespeak stuff, okay, right? And it's sort of irksome because they have these wonderful sounding titles. They just don't have anything to do with what they do. So now, the way this works is the foundations and Exxon seem to provide seed money, but you've got to go scramble for more. Now, why do you do that? Well, that means that other people have contributed, and you can sort of hide what's going on. You have camouflage. We have many funders, you know, who've donated. Yeah, but, you know, Coke gave you half your money. Anyway, as a computer guy, I'd say this is a distributed systems conspiracy. Remember when I gave you that chronology chart? These are some of those activities sorted by when they happened. Higher numbers mean more involved. What you find, well, almost everybody was involved in the attack on the hockey stick. Almost everybody is hooked in with Heartland. Right? Oh, Heartland really made its start with tobacco stuff. I mean, it's very famous for that. The point of all this is there's an international mesh of these folks involved in a lot of the same activities. Okay, so let me ask you a rhetorical question. What do you think the chances are that a lot of these people have their other email addresses in their Outlook files? Think any of these people know each other? Think any of them send each other emails? Yeah, well, I may cheat. Let me put it this way. Not everyone is as careful about where they forward emails as they should be. And I have some emails that I got perfectly legally that probably certain people will not want to see come out. Okay? And well, but they will sooner or later. So I will tell you, I've seen lots of emails that have a lot of these combinations of people. Fred Singer in particular knows everybody. Where are these entities, these think tanks and stuff? Here, what I did is I got a list, put a list together. I made a Google Maps, and there's a link to the interactive map if you want to see it. Here's where they are. You've only got a couple up here, although I missed one or two, but these are all Fraser Institute. Actually, Fraser has a branch in Indiana for some reason. I haven't figured it out, but it's there. And then there's a bunch around. You notice there's a lot over here. Well, there's so many over there, I zoomed in. This is a map of Washington, D.C., has anyone ever heard of K Street? That's Lobbyist Central. For some reason, all these scientific institutes need to be within, a block or two of Congress. That's how you do science. You must be there, right? It's great. Okay. December 2009. ClimateGate was cranking. Has anybody ever seen the Monty Python witch scene? Anyway, there are attacks on Mike. Even good science institutions are unused to this, which is why I was trying to educate the Penn State president and administration about this stuff. By now, I knew kind of how these guys worked, and I was hoping for errors that would let you roll up the network. I mean, if I have a fantasy, it's to get the Koch brothers on a witness stand having to testify, because they would not like that. So I was hoping to look at libel issues in particular, because there's been a very ugly change in the last couple years. Most of the anti-science was against the science, and it's turned into attacks on people, amplified by the internet. Again, I get peeved when somebody I know, as an honest person, who's working for people's grandchildren, and they get vilified in the press in op-eds in the Wall Street Journal, or they get eviscerated rats on their doorstep. Ben Santer heard a noise at his door. He went down. Someone in a Hummer was driving away yelling insults, and there was an eviscerated rat on his doorstep. And Ben is as nice a guy as I've ever met. He's very sweet. I mean, it's just like, you know, who needs this? Now, this Canadian surprise came up. I'm going to focus on what's been found rather than who did it, but hopefully Deep Climate will write a book about how he did all this stuff. He found this problem, like the original Watergate break-in, and then one thing led to another. There was the hockey stick, and there had been an attack going on it by the Canadians Ross McKittrick and Steve McIntyre. In one way or another, this generated the Wegman Report, usually dismissed as poor, but it's always cited by climate anti-science writings, not by scientists. Anyway, DC found several pages of plagiarism. In fact, one of the weird things is Ray Bradley is one of the authors of the original hockey stick. He wrote a classic textbook. They plagiarized it, but they distorted it to reverse some of the comments they didn't like. These are statisticians who've never done anything in this field. They stole the guy's stuff, but anytime there was something that they didn't like, they inverted it. They changed it just enough it wasn't obvious. DC somehow find this. Also, they used a very weird social network analysis stuff to try to claim that climate scientists co-authored papers with each other, so their peer review had to be bad. And they said Michael Mann was at the center of all this. Now, how did they decide he was at the center? They did a graph of all of Mike Mann's co-authors, not when he published the original paper, but years later, and he was at the center of the graph of his own co-authors. Yeah, well, you know, anyone is at the center of their graph of co-authors. They published all this crap, okay, right? Oh, it's weird. Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway had written this book, The Merchants of Doubt. It hadn't actually appeared yet, but I had been reviewing it all along because Naomi's a friend. And they especially identified the George Marshall Institute as a key 20-year provider of climate anti-science. And they were heavily embroiled in bringing McIntyre and McKittrick to Washington, introducing them to key politicians, giving them venues, all of this stuff to manufacture this attack on the hockey stick that fed into the Wegman report. DC eventually found 10 pages of 91 were plagiarized stuff. Now, if anyone's familiar with academe, plagiarism equals the end. You know, serious plagiarism. Usually it's an issue with students. You don't expect to find senior full professors doing this stuff. That's just like so weird. So I wrote this report that showed up at DSmog blog with like almost 200 pages that told about what we knew so far and how the climate machine worked, anti-science machine worked. Then later I said, well, you know, I've got a few loose ends. Maybe I'll look around some more in the Wegman report. And I thought I'd be done in a month or two. Well, 6 months later, I'd written a 250-page report because almost everything I looked at had problems. There turned out to be 35 pages of 91 that were plagiarized. And there were distortions and biases and all kinds of stuff.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. You are listening to Dr. John Mashey as he explains the chorus of climate deniers, how it works, and who pays for it.
It turned out that Ray Bradley had filed an academic misconduct complaint with George Mason University, who's basically stonewalled him. Remember, I said George Mason got a lot of money from the Koch brothers? Maybe there's a connection. I can't prove it, but it's possible. Anyway, then I finally published this thing that went through the history of this. It's basically cut and paste of electronic stuff, jiggle it around a little bit, add a few words, right? That's what it is. And this is in a report to Congress by supposed experts. We couldn't believe it. I mean, these guys are crazy. What are they doing? There were one or two pages of 91 that didn't have any problems. These are errors. These are biases where they changed the wording of things. Half of the references they had, they never referenced. I mean, they cited them like they were something, but they never mentioned them. One of them was a lovely paper on ozone in 1984 by a guy who wrote for the National Tatler tabloid, and he usually wrote about stuff like perpetual motion machines and psychic surgery and stuff like that. And they cited this guy. Okay, I was like, what? You know? It's just incredible. Oh, he went on to better, bigger and better things. He ran a talk radio show where his favorite thing was the black helicopters that would come for you if you said something bad. And they cited this guy. You know? Incredible. Basically, Canadians started some of the attacks. They got hooked up in Washington. Anybody hear of Senator James Inhofe? Yes, okay. Senator from Koch. Koch brothers are his biggest funder. He's from Oklahoma. Representative Joe Barton from Texas Oil. Anyway, they found these guys through the think tanks, brought them to Washington, gave them speaking opportunities, introduced them to Inhofe and Barton and their folks. Right? They did a key talk that is the basis for the Wegman report. You can find all the key ideas in the Wegman report or in this one talk that they did for a think tank. So, let's talk about rocks here, and I'm almost done. An amazing mass of unexpected fallouts. They had two objectives in this Canadian-American cooperation, and then there was a lot of Canadian-American cooperation in finding this stuff and exposing it. They had two things to show that the hockey stick was broken. Some of it was already fixed earlier, or should have been. And then it turned out later that all the statistics of these statistical experts was copied from the Canadians anyway, and then they cherry-picked it. They did 10,000 tests, and they picked the 100 that agreed with them, and ignored the other. So they took 1% of the data and used it to say, look, this is, it's all wrong. Okay. Well, and Deep Climate found the code for this and looked at it to see what they did. Then there was this thing to discredit climate science and scientists. And they published a paper about this, and I did a big analysis. I got experts to look at it. The real problem with this is they used plagiarism. They submitted an article to a journal where Wegman had advised for 24 years. It was accepted in 6 days. Normal thing is about 200. And it was wrong. It was just broken in lots of ways. And then they cited 3 federal research contracts. And the Army and the National Institute of Alcoholism Abuse normally don't fund bad social network analysis to attack climate scientists that has plagiarism in it. And this will get them in bad trouble. Right? The Office of Research Integrity in the U.S. is a very fierce organization, which is the watchdog for these things, and they know about this, and they're watching it. And they can do things like debar a researcher for years. Like, 0 federal funding will come your way. Not just from the health folks, anywhere in the federal government. They can actually debar institutions. And George Mason seems to be flirting with that possibility. My academic friends cannot believe this. They say, nobody messes with the Office of Research Integrity. You just don't do that. That's crazy. And then finally, misleading Congress is a felony. We now come back to British Columbia. Rocks, libel. I identified libelous attacks as something that was growing, but actually had an odd usefulness. Suppose you run around saying the moon is made of green cheese. Well, fine, you can do that. Well, nobody can stop you from saying the moon is made of green cheese. But if you publish the moon is made of green cheese and Neil Armstrong was a terrible liar for having claimed it was rocks and he's evil and bad and he should be thrown out, or should have been thrown out, that's libel. And that might actually be actionable. And in fact, finally, people are starting to take action. And for instance, a really strong, highly regarded climate scientist at UVic, Andrew Weaver, and the lawyer here, Roger McConkie, sued the National Post. This is Roger's book. If you Google Canadian libel, this comes up in the first couple books. I said, oh, good. Andrew has a good lawyer who really knows stuff. And I actually bought this book. I'm about 300 pages into 1,000. It's actually pretty well written. I can kind of understand it. And it is really thorough. And these guys are in for trouble. Then there were some things with Tim Ball and the Canada Free Press. They, in effect, apologized and ripped out all of Tim Ball's posts there. I would call this another Monty Python runaway. This is still going on. Tim's getting sued for libel, and Richard knows some interesting things there. And now Mike Mann is suing Tim Ball for libel because he wrote that Mike Mann shouldn't be at Penn State. He should be in the state pen. But anyway, this needs some help to scale up, but it's an interesting combination, and I was delighted to see it happen. And like I say, here's another one where British Columbia is pretty relevant. So here was the machinery. The idea is to defog or desmog it. I wonder about nonprofits, hope to roll this up back into the funders. The spokespeople, you watch for actionable errors like libel stuff. And here in the internet stuff, if you do libel on the internet, it rapidly propagates, but that proves that somebody believed you. Sometimes with a newspaper, it's hard to prove that real damage was done. But when you see a completely false claim created to damage someone, rapidly copied all over the place, you have prima facie evidence that someone believes it and passed it on, right? And by the way, the lawsuits they've got going all demand that not only do they pay damages, but that they go get all the copies retracted of all these blogs all over the place. That is mean, okay? And we'll see what happens, all right? Very savvy internet lawyer. Scientists like to do science. They're not into fighting PR and lobbying stuff. And I've talked to really discouraged climate scientists. I mean, really fine scientists who say, sometimes I think I should stop. I need to go help communicate or do something because it doesn't seem like the science is doing any good. And I say, stop. You folks have to keep doing the science we need, because I can't, we can't. I need good scientists to do this stuff. All of you need to know how to deal with the press and not fall over your feet when you're doing that. Some of you need to spend more time in outreach, and I know a lot of good scientists who do that, who care about communicating what's going on. And some of you who have the real talent and practice are going to have to do a lot of that. You're going to have to do less research and a lot more outreach. And Steve Schneider was the classic example of someone who did great research and then ended up shifting to more outreach and communication. And it just was a true blow, both from he was a friend and a terrific guy when he died. And then I said, and the last thing is, and some of the rest of us have got to help get these guys off your backs because it's a different skill set. So some of the bloggers around the world are good at finding stuff out and countering some of the arguments. People with PR and journalism backgrounds, like some of these folks over here at DSmogBlog. I wrote something about what to do about poor science reporting. Lots of us have got to help journalists get less confused about this. I've spent a lot of time with local papers trying to say, look, let me help you with this so that you're not confused about stuff. Let me point you at real stuff or introduce you to real scientists. Well, local paper published a ridiculous op-ed, you know, with a Gish Gallop saying things. And I wrote to them, not a letter to the editor, but said, you know, 10 miles away is Steven Schneider. Why don't you get a real scientist to write an op-ed? And you know what? Next week they did. My observation is, you know, writing letters to the editor and complaining, I much rather write positive things to a reporter who does a good job. Because they mostly hear flack. I'd rather send them stuff saying, hey, here's a good book, you know, that would help you. And, you know, over time, anybody can do this and help out. Lawyers, we need some more lawyers who know about this stuff. And after all, this is all about policy in the long run. We got to work with government in sensible ways. And, you know, there's lots of room for arguments about policy and how you do stuff. But arguments that deny basic physics just, you know, it'll catch up with us, right? And different places will get hurt different ways. So I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. You know, we got a bunch of stuff at sea level. So do you guys. And I was at a local government meeting where we went through scenarios for how to plan against sea level rise. And it wasn't nice. Let me tell you, where do you put the dikes? Do you put them outside of everybody? But that may not be sustainable very long. Well, okay, let's move back up the hill. Well, what do you think the people outside say about this? Well, the politics going to get exciting. Also, there's a minor issue that you have more of than we don't. Suppose you put up a 3-foot seawall outside of everything here. What happens? Does it rain behind that? Well, the sea level is 3 foot higher. You got to pump out, right? The Dutch are pretty good at this, okay, right? This is not like just a storm that comes in and you get a flood, but then it goes away. The water comes in and it stays there because you're below sea level, right? People haven't thought about that too much. There's also saltwater incursion. Of course, here in British Columbia, how many people know about the bark beetles? Okay, they're chewing up your forests up there. Well, when I run into somebody who doesn't believe global warming, I said, you know, I was sitting in a ski lodge with a couple lumber guys up in at Big White. And you know what? They didn't have any doubts about warming because they could see the bark beetles coming because the only thing that kills them is sharp cold spells. I say, so you should go tell them there's no such thing as global warming, but be warned. They're big guys and they know how to use axes. Because they can see it, right? It's not a question of numbers on a chart. You can see BC has great websites that show the waves of the bark beetles going up. That's pretty scary. Anyway, there's different problems, different places. There's different policies. There's legitimate arguments, but simply trying to nullify the science isn't one of them. So machine does not like this kind of visibility. That's why I'm on some people's bad lists. That's why Naomi Oreskes is on some people's bad lists, because they don't like the exposure. And the rocks in the gears is what we're trying to get with the libel stuff and with the misuse of funds and the academic misconduct things. I don't know, you know, it may take a while, but there was a time last Thanksgiving I almost was on a plane to Washington to testify to Congress. It didn't quite come off. They couldn't get everything together, but people were getting more interested in this stuff.
That was Dr. John Massey. He was chief scientist at the world's supercomputer maker, Silicon Graphics, just part of his long business career. When Massey found out top climate scientists were being harassed, while fake institutes pushed out lies to the public, he stepped into an investigation that has taken years of patience. I recorded the speech as presented by the Pacific Institute for Climate Solutions on April 7, 2011. Find the lecture notes, including detailed charts and graphs, naming names and showing links for the hidden world of climate denial at www.pics.uvic.ca. That's pics.uvic.ca. Or look for the link in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. Please download this speech as a free MP3 from the Radio EcoShock archives. The program date is July 27, 2011. Our main website is ecoshock.org. Play this speech for your local group meetings. Pass it along to those in doubt. Real science and the laws of physics will win in the end. We can't lie to ourselves about that. I'm Alex Smith, on vacation. Please understand if I don't reply to your email until September. Thank you so much for listening and for caring about your world.